Okay, so last time we got to a pretty exciting place where we see from the point of view of one-dimensional quantum mechanics what causes bonding, that is, what makes the energy of electrons go down when they're between nuclei. And as we said, the reward for finding psi is the knowledge of everything, including dynamics and bonding. So last time we saw that if we had a single Hooke's law, we would expect that the red energy would be too high and the blue energy would be too low, and the true energy would be in between these two. Okay, but in fact, that wasn't the problem. It was a double minimum where there were two attractors for the object that we're interested in, the particle we're interested in. And these, in fact, are true solutions. But what this shows is that the correct single minimum solution is between the other two in its energy. One's lower and one's higher when you have a double minimum of this sort. Now, what if those two wells were further apart, so the particle had further to go over this hill between to get from one to the other? Suppose instead of 0.6 angstroms, suppose it's 1.3 angstroms. And now if you look at the solutions here for 1.3 angstroms, where I've faded out the ones from 0.6 angstroms, you can see that these solutions are in fact the same as each other, and the same as the single minimum solution. That is, they didn't undergo this splitting or the separation of energies, one lower and one higher, when they were further apart. But when they come together, right? So if the wells get closer, then you lower the energy of the favorable one and raise the energy of the unfavorable one. So if the particle is only in the more favorable, that is the blue wave function, then its energy will get lower if these two things come closer together. Does everybody see that? Because that's what bonding is. That's why electrons get more stable. When the two nuclei that are attracting them get closer together, the energy of the blue wave function becomes lower than it would be if they were separated from one another. Okay? And you can see that it has lower total energy because it has lower curvature. The kinetic energy has gotten lower. Aviva, you look like your brow is furrowed. Is it really clear to you? Okay, if not, this is the time to say it. Okay, it seems unnatural, because it seems unnatural that kinetic energy should be what it is, this curvature of a wave function divided by a wave function. But if you swallow that, it's not too difficult to see that this is the situation. Okay, so that effect of the two wave functions for a double minimum moving apart from one another, flanking what they would be if there were just a single minimum, or if they were far apart, if the wells were far apart, this is called splitting of the, and the closer they get together, the bigger the splitting is. Okay, so you have localized wave functions for one particle or the other particle. If it were on A, you have the blue function on the left. If it were on B, you have the blue function on the right. But, and if you consider the two taken together and they're very far apart, you get the blue function shown here, which has the same curvatures, the same energy, everything looks the same. But if you bring them close together, then you get this new, less curved blue function, and the particle is more stable. All right? By the same token, when you bring them, and that's what holds A and B together, but by the same token, when you bring them together, you get this wave function is a possibility as well, but you don't want to use that one because that one is higher in energy than they would be if they were separated, and for that reason is called what? Anti-bonding. Because if there were a particle in that wave function, it would favor the things moving apart rather than coming together. Its energy would be lower when they are apart. So when you bring two minima together, right, their wave functions mix, and you get a favorable one and an unfavorable one, bonding and antibonding. Yeah, Brian?
How do you know the antibonding one is higher?
Because it has more curvature, right? Okay, now, so that's bonding, but you also see something interesting about dynamics here. Sagar?
What is A and B?
A and B are two different minima, or they could, in the case of a three-dimensional atom that we'll be talking about later, they're the nuclei of two atoms. So an electron could be on nucleus A, like a hydrogen atom, or it could be on nucleus B. But if those two nuclei get close together, you get a new wave function, which goes over both of them, which is lower in energy, that's bonding, or higher in energy, that's antibonding, the one that has a node.
And if they're farther apart, you have a higher...
If you move the nuclei farther apart, then the wave function of the particle looks just like the two, right? Has same curvature. So same energy. If they're far apart, you have the same energy whether it's on both of them or on only one of them. Okay? Yeah, Mike?
How do you know that for the one with one node, it favors the particles being farther apart?
Because the energy of that one is higher than the energy it would have if they were far apart. So if they move far apart, its energy will be lower. Its wave function will be lower in energy. Make sense?
Like, you know, we're saying that there are protons and electrons going through this potential. Like, we're using like 1 AMU. Is that just like to model it?
Yeah. Well, we're just showing how quantum mechanics works. And this is one particle in one dimension. We're going to get to atoms later. But the same factor is what's involved. Pardon me?
It won't be like a proton.
No, and it'll be Coulombic potential when we're talking nuclei, and the particle will be very much lighter, which means it can move much further, right? Its wave is much more spread out when it has a lower mass in the denominator. Okay? I'm going to turn this light off. Where is it? There we go. Okay, now, there's a really interesting thing about this that you're not supposed to understand because it depends on time. Dynamics is time, right? And that's time dependence. But I'm just going to give you the conclusion from it because it's very interesting with respect to this splitting of these two levels in a double minimum. Okay, suppose you have a particle and you stop it there and it's classical and you're going to let it roll. So you let it go and it rolls back and forth, rolls down and up to the same height and then back and up to the same height and then back and up to the same height if there's no friction or anything. Okay? But what happens in quantum mechanics is it can get to the other well, even though it has only that total amount of energy, only enough to get that high. It goes, what they say, it tunnels through that barrier between the two wells and then gets into the other one. Now, this tunneling, that looks weird, right? It's because it's wrong. Right? This is a pet peeve, the word tunneling, but it's what I think about it has nothing to do with whether people use it or not. They'll keep talking about it as tunneling forever. But it's misleading because it suggests that there's something weird about the potential energy, that you can dig this tunnel and have a lower potential energy than you would have if you went over the top. But that's not what's involved. The potential energy is given to you. There really does have that potential energy. What's special is that the kinetic energy can be negative, so the thing can go up over the top, right? So what really happens in tunneling is that these pink areas are forbidden. They're areas where the potential energy is higher than the total energy for that, sort of for the average curve there. Okay, that means that classically the particle cannot, with that total energy, can't be in those regions. But in fact, we know it can be in those regions, in the pink regions. So in fact, what it can do is go right up over the top with negative kinetic energy and then back down in the other one. Right? And it's no weirder that it can go over the top than it can come out here, where it also has negative kinetic energy. Right? And in fact, you see that the probability of being in the middle is in fact higher, the wave function is higher, than for being out at this position in that tail of the wave function. Right? So if you believe that kinetic energy is what we say it is, then this tunneling is nothing weird. It just goes over there. Now you might wonder, how fast does it get from one to the other? And that, of course, is a time-dependent question. If you know at the beginning that it's in one well, how long will it take to get to the other well? You're going to have to do something that has to do with time. And it turns out that the conclusion from time-dependent quantum mechanics is that the time it takes to go from one well to the other is 5 times 10 to the minus 14 seconds divided by whatever that splitting of the blue and the red is. Isn't that weird? It's easy to show with time-dependent quantum mechanics. Maybe I'll show you someday. But anyhow, that's the formula. And I just assert it here. I'm not proving it to you because it comes from time-dependent quantum mechanics. So that means if these two differ by 1.4 kilocalories per mole, how long does it take to go from one well to the other? It takes about 4 times 10 to the minus 14th seconds to get from one to the other. It's 5 divided by 1.4. Okay, so we can know everything with this, dynamics and bonding. And pretty soon we're going to be getting to reactivity. Okay? And we can do complicated things like the Morse potential. Right, or we can rank these energies and the Morse potential by their curvature, by their number of nodes. So we're in a pretty good shape, and we can recognize wave functions that are wrong. Like, look at this wave function. Right, what's wrong? How do you know? If I showed you this, what would you point to that shows that this can't possibly be right, Matt? Can't hear very well.
You have positive energy in that gray area.
No, the kinetic energy in this gray area. Oh yeah. Oh, in the middle. Right. Right. That's wrong. Definitely wrong. Good. In fact, when I drew this, it's obviously wrong. I didn't even think of that. Good point. So it can't have positive kinetic energy. Well, that depends. Wait a second. That depends on what the total energy is. If the total energy is up here, then it's okay. So we can't say that's wrong, but it's a good thing to think about. Yeah. Derek?
In a similar vein, the curvature for all the peaks and troughs is approximately the same, which implies that the kinetic energy is relatively constant and positive, but the small potential energy maximum in between shows that there should be some kind of...
You know, that's hard to know. Yeah, I see what you're saying, but it's hard to think about this quantitatively because it depends on the curvature, and I don't know. The curvature here may be a little less than it is up there, but the amplitudes are a little different. It's not too easy to know that kind of thing, but there's something here that's really wrong. Yeah. I can't hear very well. It doesn't look like they're becoming asymptotically zero, right? On the right here. That's the way that wave function goes. It crosses and keeps curving away, so it's got to go to negative infinity. And the one here looks like it's becoming asymptotic, but it's not becoming asymptotic to zero. Right? And in fact, what it'll do is curve and go to positive infinity. So what happens out in the tails of this wave function, it can't possibly be a right one. But anyhow, from what you already know and from doing the problems and so on and a little bit of practice, you can see that those can't be right. Okay, so forget those. Okay, so we're great on lots and lots of things. We can even handle multiple minima and see what bonding, the idea of what bonding is going to involve when we get in more dimensions, right? However, this Erwin won't work. The approach won't work if you're in more dimensions. Right? So you're going to have to use fancier math than that. And the reason is because now when you're in many dimensions, there can be curvature in X, curvature in Y, curvature in Z. So knowing the difference between potential and kinetic doesn't tell you the curvature, right? Because it's a lot of different curvatures and you don't know how much to put where. So that's a problem. But Schrödinger, when he thought up this thing, didn't have any trouble finding the solutions. And the reason he didn't have any trouble finding them was that he already knew them. He didn't do the math to find them. He already had studied these when he was your age, right? In classical mechanics, right? Because they were around forever. For example, Chladni figures. Now here's Ernst Florenz Friedrich Chladni, right? And he published this book. The first edition was 1803, but I forgot to bring, I have in my office from the library, a copy of the 1830 second edition. Okay, and what he was studying, as you can see, acoustics. So he was looking at waves. So what he would do is take a plate of glass or of metal, and he would bow it with a violin bow and make it vibrate. And he would put on the surface of it sand or flour, and it would jump around as the plate vibrated. And it would collect in regions that weren't vibrating. What do you call the regions that don't vibrate it? A node, right? So it shows the pattern of nodes when you bow this thing. Okay? Now he would touch the plate in different places, and he would bow it in different places, and he would get different tones, different vibration patterns, and he was interested in studying how these related to pitch. The sand, as I said, would collect in the node. Now we're going to do it a different way. Here we got a brass plate. And there I have some little rubber feet. So I'm going to put these things here. And put this on. Okay, and now I've got some sand here. And now I'm no good at the violin. So we're going to have to make it vibrate a different way. We're going to use dry ice. So there we have a brass plate, right? And I'm going to bring a sharp piece of dry ice down, and when it touches, CO2 will expand and push the plate away, right? But once the plate's away, you're not warming the dry ice anymore, so no more CO2. That CO2 will dissipate, and the plate will come back. But when it touches again, you'll get another burst of CO2, and then another, and another. So it'll make the plate vibrate. So instead of using a violin, I'm going to use dry ice. Okay, now this is a touchy thing. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. And if you touch sand, it won't conduct heat. Right? So you have to be able to touch the plate itself. So let me just get a little bit of the sand out of the way. So the dry ice will touch the plate. Thanks to the Miller Group for dry ice. Oh, hear that? Did you hear it? It's doing the same thing with the table. Okay, but let's see what happens here. Sometimes this works, sometimes it doesn't. Now, so you who are musicians will notice that there were several different tones there, right? It wasn't a pure tone. So if knowing how to play this is not trivial, and I'm not so good at playing it, if I generate a really clear tone, it's really neat. But I don't want there to be ice on here, and I want to just touch in one place if possible. So let me put a little more sand on. And we'll just try a couple times. If you go on the web, you can watch a really good one I lucked out with once. That's noisy. But if I go around, I might find a pure tone. That's noisy, obviously. Let me try over here. I hope I get a good one because it's so dramatic, but we won't waste too much time. Let me try in the middle just for fun. See what it was doing?
Yeah.
I lost it, but it was going to make three circles when I had that pure tone. Nuts. I had it in it. Trouble is that when I cool the, you see that's coming to three circles? Sometimes it's beautiful. I'll show you some others here. If you want to come and try afterwards, you're welcome. It's fun. Okay. So here are some that I've made before in class or otherwise. There's that three circles that we were heading toward. There's a diameter plus two circles. There's three diameters in one circle. And there's four diameters in one circle. I was hoping to get something like that, but I'm not good enough at playing the brass plate. Okay, so these are pictures from Chladni's book from 1803. Figure 99, figure 100, figure 101A and 102A. And here are a bunch of others in table 6. Now look at 106 there in the middle and we'll understand what it means. Or the one beneath it here. So here's color, where blue means the plate is coming toward you, and yellow means it's going away, and green means it's at the average position. So another way of plotting it is this, where those red things denote the nodes that are where the sand would collect in this picture. Right? So there are two circular nodes and one diametric node. And then as the thing vibrates, it goes up and down in between the nodes. The nodes don't move up and down. Right? So that particular one is one diameter and two circles that Chladni illustrated there. Okay, but what he was interested in, remember, was the acoustics, what sound is going to be made. So he has this table which talks about 47 different patterns, and remember figure 99 is the one we showed, which was it was two diameters, three diameters, four diameters, five diameters, and so on, right? And then, so going across the top is the number of diametrical nodes, coming down here is the number of circular nodes. Okay, and then he gives for each one what its pitch is, like C, D, C, or, and then some of them are a little bit sharp or a little bit flat, which he denotes with plus or minus. But what you notice is that these pitches, here he tries to then make sense out of this, because they're different ways of getting the same pitch, right? So here he says that the pitch goes with the square of the number formed in this table. So on one axis of the table he has the number of circles, the other one is the number of diameters. So he can have none, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 circles, and from 0 to 8 diameters, right? And mixtures of them. And then what he does is he takes how many diametrical nodes plus twice the number of circular nodes, which gives a number. You square it, and that's proportional to the pitch, the frequency of the sound that you hear. Okay? Okay, so for example, you can have one circle or two lines, and you get the number 2 by adding together, and the same pitch. Or you can have increasing ways of getting the same pitch if you're talking about higher pitches, bigger numbers. For example, 8 for the number. It could be 4 circles, 3 circles and 2 lines, 2 circles and 4 lines, a circle and 6 lines, or 8 lines, and all of them would be the same pitch. Right? So it's in that sense degenerate. There are different ways of getting the same result, the same frequency. Now, great mathematicians worked. Chladni was an experimentalist. He didn't know how to treat this theoretically. This was just a numerical relationship he observed. But great mathematicians worked on how to understand the vibrations of violin strings and and plates like this and timpani heads and so on. So people like Bernoulli, 1700 to 1782, and Euler worked on this. He's also on a Swiss banknote. And Lagrange and Laplace. Incidentally, Laplace, this symbol del, as it's called here, an upside down delta, del squared is this operator. Have you ever seen that before? That's what you use to get the kinetic energy. These were old things in mechanics. Yeah. Pardon me? Oh, I forgot to substitute y and z. It's dx squared, dy squared, dz squared. Sorry, I just copied them. Obviously, I'll fix that. But that's called the Laplacian. These were all old times things. Schrödinger wasn't making great strides in mathematics when he solved this Schrödinger equation, right? Now, the size for one electron atoms involve another thing due to Laplace, which is the idea of spherical harmonics, which are the way that spheres can vibrate rather than drum heads or violin strings. So they're 3D analogs of the figures that Chladni developed. Now, the three-dimensional hydrogen atom wave functions, psi, can be written as a product of three functions. And those functions, which we're going to see, were contributions from other old-time mathematicians. For example, the R function is called the associated Laguerre function. You don't have to remember this. It's just that these were well known to Schrödinger. So Laguerre from the 19th century had developed those R functions. And Legendre from the late 18th, early 19th century got the associated Legendre polynomial, which is these theta functions. Okay, now, so here is a table that gives you the solution for three-dimensional problem, the hydrogen atom, one nucleus, one electron, right? So the position of the electron, essentially, it's actually, the nucleus, remember, is 1,000 times heavier than the electron. You actually measure relative to the center of mass, okay, which is practically the nucleus. Right, it's just a little bit toward the electron from the nucleus, right? So as the electron moves, the nucleus moves the opposite way with respect to the center of mass, but hardly at all. So there's no kinetic energy really associated with the nucleus for the atom, right? It's just the electron moving that you have to do the Laplacian for. So anyhow, these are the solutions. So there are only three dimensions relative to the center of mass. The position, say, of the electron and the nucleus is just a faint mirror image of it. Right? So there are three numbers. So if you have the nucleus here practically at the origin and the electron moving around at a certain XYZ, right? These are the solutions you get, and we'll get in. It looks pretty forbidding, I admit, but we'll get there, and you'll see it's really pretty simple. Okay, now this depends on that. Remember, what you're given is the potential energy and the mass of the electron, and you're to find these wave functions. Right? Now, the potential energy is simple. It's 1 over r squared. Right, the distance squared. But the distance squared is x squared plus y squared plus z squared. You know that. That's r squared. Okay? So it's that. However, that is a really complicated function to deal with and do these derivatives and get solutions. Right? It's very complicated to get psi as a function of x, y, and z. But you can do a neat mathematical trick that makes it much, much easier if you're into this kind of thing. And that's what these old-time mathematicians had done. Right? And they knew that if you change the coordinate system from being Cartesian to being spherical polar coordinates, so you have r and theta and phi as the variables rather than x, y, and z, that is how far out it is from the nucleus, how far down from the axis, and how far around the equator. Right, r, theta, and phi. If those are your variables, then you have a much easier potential. What's the potential energy if you use these coordinates? It's 1 over r. 1 r squared is the force. 1 over r is the energy. Okay, so now the potential energy is really simple. It depends only on R. And because the potential energy depends only on R, these things are much easier to do mathematically. Not that you can do them, but Schrödinger had no problem doing them because all these people had worked out these problems long before. And it had been shown that you can write the function that solves this differential equation as an R function, a theta function, and a phi function. Each R is a function only of the distance, theta function is a function only of the angle theta, and the phi function is a function only of this angle around here, phi. So now, each of those simple functions is a function of only one variable, and you can appreciate that it would make the math much easier than to have x squared plus y squared plus z squared square root to deal with. Okay, so you can name psi. You can get different ones of these by choosing different r, theta, and phi functions. You name psi by quantum numbers, n, l, and m, or by a nickname like 1s. And now we can look at the table and find out how these are. So here are r functions, here are theta functions, here are phi functions. So you choose one from each column, like a restaurant where you can choose something from A, something from B, something from C. But there's a choice. If you choose something in the first column, then you're limited in your choice in the second and third column. So for example, suppose we chose the N and L, R is it. The R function you choose is denoted by NL. So suppose you choose N to be 1 and L to be 0. They have to be integers to be solutions. Okay. So then this is the function you use for the R function. Right? And then, since you've chosen 0 for L, you have to choose 0 for L here. And that's only the first one has 0 for L. Right? And that means you have 0 for M. So now you have to choose 0 for M here. So that very first choice then would be, well, first I was going to tell you, notice something about the R column. Every one of them begins with Z over A0 to the 3/2. Right? Now, Z is the atomic number. It's a number. How many protons? A0 is the unit you use to measure distances, which is called the Bohr radius. It's half an angstrom, 0.53 angstroms. Okay, so Z over A0 to the 3/2 multiplies all these functions. Whatever R function you choose, you got that in there, right? But when you square it, you're going to get Z cubed over A0 cubed. Z is a number, so that's a number per unit volume. Right? The length cubed is a volume. So that's the units you want for probability density. How likely per unit volume. So that's the only place where units appear here in that A0.
So you square it when we're doing probability density.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right, to get probability density. This is the wave function we're writing here, and you'll square it to get probability density. Okay. Now, let's do the 1s. Okay, so we take something from column A, something from column B, something from column C, and that's what we take. Okay, so but notice that there's only one variable in the whole thing. It's all numbers like pi and 2 and things like that and square root of 2 and things, right? The only thing that's a variable is that number rho, that variable rho, exponential to the minus rho. So it's some constant times e to the minus rho over 2, and when you square it, it's going to be k squared times e to the minus rho. Right? If you square e to the minus rho over 2, you get e to the minus rho. Okay. Now, what is the constant? Well, for this 1s that we're talking about here, the constant is z over a0 to the 3/2 times 2 times then this variable, this thing here, and then times square root of 2 over 2 times 1 over the square root of 2 pi. But you can simplify that a lot, right? Because those 2's will cancel and the square root of 2's will cancel. And then if you square this, what you're going to get, if it's hydrogen, so z is 1, you're going to get in the denominator just square root of pi squared, which is pi, and a0, which remember is 0.53 angstroms cubed. And that turns out to be 2.14 per cubic angstrom. That's the density when rho equals 0. right? If rho equals zero, this thing is one, so the density is going to be k squared. Is everybody with me on this? Any questions? Yeah. It's the probability density of the electron at a particular position, or in a it's the density at that position is something per cubic angstrom. Okay, it's the probability per cubic angstrom, and the probability is 2.14 for cubic angstrom when rho is zero. Now, why do we use rho when we were talking about functions of R? I'm just going to tell you. Why do we use rho? Rho is defined as 2z over na0 times r. So it's a constant times r. But that constant will be different depending on what atom you use. That is, what z you use, how many protons in the nucleus. And it'll also differ depending on what n is, whether it's a 1s or a 2s or a 3s or a 4s orbital. Why do it this way? Why put in rho instead of r? It's because then this thing works for every atom. Whatever its z is, you just plug it into this formula. All you have to do is change the distance you measure in, something proportional to r, and you get, so all these atoms are just scaled from one another. One's more expanded than the other. Got the idea? All we're doing is changing distance when we do this. So you can write in a very, you know, physicists like to write things in a very condensed way, general way. So this table will apply now to any atom, any nucleus, as long as it has only one electron. Okay? Okay, so that allows writing the same e to the minus rho over 2 for any nuclear charge and any n. Yeah?
So, but if it's only one electron, wouldn't that only work for the group 1 atoms?
No, it works for carbon 5 plus.
Oh, right?
Which has the carbon nucleus but just one electron.
So
Mike?
It's constant probability density for the first electron.
Pardon me?
So it's constant probability density for the first electron.
What do you mean constant?
You said it was 2.14 for it.
That's when rho equals, that's what k is. So if rho equals zero, what do you know? R equals zero. Okay? If the 1s function depends on rho,
right,
which is proportional to r.
Well, 1s, by 1s you mean the psi function for the 1s electron, right?
Yeah.
So it's the probability density is constant.
No, it's not. It depends on what r is. Depends on what rho is. The probability density is this squared, which is k squared, which is roughly 2, right, electrons per cubic angstrom, times e to the minus rho. After we've squared it. So it's e to the minus rho is going to look like this as you go further out. So it'll be a certain value at the nucleus and less as you go out. Now you asked earlier about where the nucleus is, where the electron is most probable. Where is it most probable if this is true? Where's the density highest? How close? At zero. When the electron is on the nucleus, it's maximum. Okay? That's what the wave, this is the only one you'll see that's a real solution. This is absolutely true, except it's not corrected for relativity. And in fact, when the electron gets really near the nucleus, so its kinetic energy gets really, really, really high, then you have to worry about relativity, because it's going so fast. Right, so it's not correct for that, but for almost everything, these are absolutely correct wave functions. So people have shown you pictures of wave of atomic orbitals and things like that, but these are the real thing, right? And now you can easy write them down. Like this one is nothing; it's a constant times e to the minus distance, right? So you can do tests in your mind of what does the atom look like? How would I draw this? If I were drawing pictures rather than the people that wrote the textbooks, how would I draw this function of rho or rho squared, the dense or of psi or psi squared? Sharif?
Why does it have the greatest probability density at the nucleus?
Because Schrödinger's equation works. And this is the solution of Schrödinger's equation.
Okay.
Yeah. I can't hear very well. The probability is 2.14 per cubic angstrom. What's the total probability going to be? 1. How can it be 2? It's 2 per cubic angstrom, but it doesn't have that value over a very big volume. Well, it's only over a very small volume that it has such a small thing. To get probability, you multiply density by volume, right? And it's only over a small volume that it's that big. Okay. Now, notice that every one of these, every R function is e to the minus rho over 2. They're all the same. So it's really, this table isn't nearly as complicated as it looks. Right? Although there are other things that have to do with rho in these other functions. The first one has only e to the minus rho, but they all have e to the minus rho. Now, why is that no surprise for a Coulombic potential? That they all have e to the minus rho. Yeah?
Because it's any of the
right. The potential energy approaches a constant value, zero, and when it's flat and the total energy is down here, you have a constant negative potential energy, and that's e to the minus rho. Right? So at some part of it, it has to be e to the minus rho. Okay, when it's in the forbidden region. Okay, so here, so this is the all-purpose curve, e to the minus rho. That's the square of that part of the wave function, right? Starts at 1 at the nucleus and decays away for the 1s orbital, where that's all there is to it, that times a constant. Now, just let's look at an example. So that's what R is. So R, if this plot is going to be applied to a hydrogen atom, right, the 1s orbital of hydrogen, it's going to be R is 0.53 over 2 times rho. So this plot, which we made with the rho coordinate, if we want it to be angstroms as applied to hydrogen, it's going to be 0.5 here and 1 angstrom here. And the probability is going to start at 1 and exponentially decay away as we get away from the hydrogen nucleus. And at the hydrogen nucleus, it's about 2 electrons per cubic angstrom. But Victor, you see what I'm talking now? That it's only over a very small range that it has such a very high value. So there's not much volume you multiply by there. Okay, now suppose we were doing carbon instead, the 1s orbital of carbon. Now we've got z in the denominator, so it's 2 times 6 or 12. So now if we were doing carbon, this is only 0.1 angstrom and 0.2 angstroms that we would plot here. Okay, when we translate from rho to r. Okay, or in other words, they're different angstrom scales. We could put them on the same scale by drawing the carbon function in like this. But notice that's reasonable to draw it in by a factor of 6 because you're sucking the 1s electron toward the nucleus. Is that reasonable? Why do you suck it toward the nucleus? Because you add much more charge, 6 times the charge. So it's the same shape, but it gets sucked toward the nucleus. Sagar, you...
The probability is highest if you find
an
electron.
The probability what?
The probability density is highest near the electron, near the nucleus.
Not near the nucleus. At the nucleus.
How come all electrons are
Why is the wave function not a delta function at the nucleus? Why isn't all the probability at the nucleus and none anywhere else? Jordan? No, but why is it a cloud? Why isn't it an infinitesimal cloud, really dense? Right? Pardon me? No, it's only one electron. Don? No, but you could have the density could be big enough to be that. How do you know it has much kinetic energy if it's right at the nucleus? Because its wave function would look like this. Foom, foom. That's the only place. It's fabulously curved. It would have too high a kinetic energy if it minimized its potential energy by being on the nucleus. It has to spread out to minimize its total energy. Does that make sense?
What does it mean? The probability density is so
It just means it has a very high density there. But it doesn't have it over a very big volume, so the total probability of being in this little box near the nucleus is not all that high. And we're going to talk about that a lot more.
But the total probability is supposed to remain constant, right? But if you suck the 1s...
Oh, yeah, exactly. So when we've sucked it in like that,
yeah,
we obviously have to renormalize it to make it 6 times higher if it's 6 times closer. So we got to make it like that or like that. Right? Yeah.
Does the carbon have a greater atomic radius, though?
It has more than one electron.
Oh, I see.
This, we're talking the 1s electron. We could do the 2s or the 2p. You could do that for Wednesday, right? Plug in 2 for n and do 2s, see how big it is. But remember, in all cases, it's still a one electron atom. You're talking about carbon 5+, not a carbon atom. Okay, but at least you could write the correct wave function for that. Okay, now what would the exponential part of the 2s look like? Now we're getting to your question, right? If it was 2s rather than 1s. Well, n is going to be 2 down here. So things are going to get doubled up on you, right? So here are these, some of these problems for Wednesday. Why, if you understand Chladni figures, you'll understand why the pattern can't look like a Mercedes symbol. Why it's always an even number of radii. Why it's diameters rather than an odd number of radii. Okay, so that's a good one. Why are the first two cells in that table vacant? Did you notice that one that had the numbers in? The top left cells were vacant. Why? Then compare 1SH with 2S carbon in energy. And there are 6 atomic orbital problems that you can get by clicking there or going to the course website. Okay, so this is just exercise to use these. So you see that they're really easy to use. There's nothing complicated in math here. Okay, so that's 1S. And notice it's much simpler than it was in one dimension. Remember when we did Coulombic potential in one dimension, it went like this. Right, it was a complicated shape. This one is just like this. It's just it's like this. Exponential going away that way. Exponential going away that way from the nucleus. Any way you go from the nucleus, just an exponential. Okay, now how about 2s? Well, we're going to take those three if we're doing 2s. Okay, now, but what that is a bunch of constants. All these constants, 2, square root of 2, and pi, and so on. But here's e to the minus rho, that's everywhere. But it's times 2 minus rho, that's what's new. Right? Now, what interesting property is that way, that shape going to have if it's got 2 minus rho multiplying it? Can you see what's going to happen? What happens when rho equals 2, when you're 2 units out from the nucleus? What, Richard? It's 0. It has a node, and what's the shape of the node? It's a sphere of radius 2. Okay? And inside it, it's going to be positive, and outside it, it's going to be negative. But it's going to cross through 0 at 2. Or you could multiply it by minus 1, and it would go from negative to positive. You could choose either way, but it's the same function. What's happening here? Okay, now how about 2pz? Okay, here's 2pz. We take 2p and we want z. So m is 0. So we multiply this times this times this. And now it's a more complicated thing. It's some kind bunch of constants times rho times cosine of theta. It depends on theta now. It's not spherical anymore. Times e to the minus rho over 2. Now, rho times the cosine of theta. Rho is r, remember, just measured in the proper units. And cosine of theta. Can you see what rho cosine of theta is in this picture? Rho, what? Rho times the cosine of theta is z. Right? So if we wanted to mix our metaphors here, our coordinate systems, we could say it's some constant, a different constant, times z, times e to the minus rho over 2. See, we're mixing our coordinate systems. This is polar coordinates, and this is Cartesian coordinates, but it's easy to see what's going on if you write it that way. Now, so that's what it is. It's whatever value z the electron has, times e to the minus distance over, okay? Now, can you guess what 2px and 2py look like? Can you guess what they look like? What the formula is for 2px? Caitlin, can you guess? This is the formula for 2pz. The name of it is 2pz. Can you guess the formula for 2px? No? Matthew?
Is it times cosine
b? Yeah, well, simpler.
X.
Put x there, or y there, and you've got the 2px or the 2py. So these problems that you have for Wednesday are just to plug in here, but the challenge is not to write the formula. The challenge is to draw a picture and see what these real wave functions, the real solutions of Schrödinger's equation, look like. And enjoy it while you can, because this one electron atom is the only problem that you can write correct wave functions for. There isn't any other. That's too bad. Okay, so we'll stop there now. I'm sorry we didn't get further. Incidentally, you might want to look at the subsequent things because they'll help you in doing the problem set. There are different ways of plotting these functions, which is what the problem set asks you to do. I'll leave those slides on there for now.
I have a bunch of questions. So the first question is, for 2s, how can you tell again that it's a sphere?
Because it depends only on r, only on rho.
Okay.
The only thing, the value depends only on the distance. It doesn't depend on the angle. So you go out to a certain distance and it's the same value no matter which direction you go. So it's spherically symmetric.
Right, that makes sense.
Makes sense?
Yeah. And then,
but to see the other one, the next one depended on theta. Mm-hmm. And subsequent ones you'll see depend on phi too.
Yeah.
So they're more complicated.
Okay. And then I had a question about the problem set that's due today. So I did it, but there was this one part where you could adjust for the bond strength. You could adjust.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
When you set the potential, you put in what the bond strength was.
Yeah.
When you chose the potential.
What does that?
Oh wait, wait. No, not bond strength. It was
something else.
The binding energy.
Yeah, but it's something that is analogous somehow to the strength of the bond. Right. If you made it 2, that means the bond is stronger.
That's for the motion. What do you know? What particle you're talking about? You're talking about a proton or a heavier particle, a heavier atom, nucleus, vibrating, held by a spring or by a Morse potential.
Okay.
So you have to say, how strong is that spring? Is it the equivalent of a single bond, a double bond, a triple bond,
okay,
a 1.5 bond?
And that...
So you're defining the potential.
That alters the energy, the total energy.
It'll alter what your solutions are. And you want to find out how.
And so... What actually matches what happens in the electron is a double minima?
What we're illustrating is a proton in a double minimum.
Okay.
But the bond is really an electron in a double minimum.
Okay.
And it's a different sort of double minimum. It's a coulombic potential rather than held by springs on either side.
Okay.
Right? So that's different.
Yeah.
Right? But the principle is the same of having a double minimum and what the waves look like as they mix. Right?
So there's still tunneling given a coulombic potential?
Yeah. Yeah, there better be, because the electron that's in a bond goes to both nuclei. So it has to get back and forth.
Okay. But I can visualize, like, in double minima, the electron moving over the hill in the middle, right?
Yeah.
Gaining that negative kinetic energy,
yeah,
such that it can go to the other side. Where is that boundary that it must go over?
If you're talking, say, the hydrogen molecule ion, two nuclei, one electron. So you have a nucleus here and a nucleus here at a given distance. And the potential looks like this. Right? That's a coulombic potential for this one. And then it goes like that for that one. And then the one for this looks like this.
So it's a double coulombic.
So this is the double well that the electron exists in. And the wave function is going to look like this.
and then the total energy will have to be...
Oh, I just thought I got to help these guys here. Here, let's get less sand on there. And maybe the feet aren't in quite the right place. Let me move the feet out just a bit and see if that helps.
Should I come?
Get this out of the way.
Yeah, I haven't gone over there.
And you need a place to touch it. So let's just try there.
Like the final's gonna be a little hard.
And it has to be sharp and no ice on it.
Yeah,
okay, good.
So here, you can use this to knock some off. Here, I'll get it for you.
Yeah. Everyone I've talked to in the class said,
okay, there's a sharp point there, right? And try to make it a pure tone. I see what's developing. See, once the brass gets cold, it won't evaporate the CO2 anymore. So now try someplace else where the brass is not cold. Yeah.
So, like, I know you said it's we're the double minimum, and you have like the two energy levels.
Yeah.
And, like, it's dependent on the difference between them. The splitting.
Yeah.
And you said it's like based on the time-dependent quantum mechanics.
But just, yeah.
I was just wondering, because I emailed you and asked you, like, does it like change levels? And you said it doesn't change levels, right? The particle doesn't... I was just wondering how the two levels interact. Like, what's the significance of having two levels like that?
Well, you get... When you take these two waves... Each of these individual wells would have a wave in it. When you have both wells there, you have both waves. But you can put both waves as a sum, that looks like that. Or you can have the two waves as a difference, that looks like that. Okay?
Yeah.
And those have different energies. The one that's a difference is more curved. Right? So one has less curvature, the one that goes like this, and one has more curvature. So one's lower and one's higher than what it would be if it were just in one well. Right? And the difference in energy between those two tells you how fast the particle gets back and forth.
How does it tell you that? Like
it's because the time dependent Schrödinger equation has e to the I, imaginary number, times the energy. And so you have this one and this one, and they have this one and this one. They have different energies. So they beat against one another in time to become a sum or a difference. Now, if you have this... let me turn this off. Yes.
Although it does have the value of sum.
If you have this wave...
Yes, yes.
And this wave...
That's not really something that you can really intuit. You know, so you want to just think in terms of total...
Right? And you take their sum, the sum of those. One's high energy, one's lower energy. If you take the sum of the two, you get this. If you take the difference of the two, you get this. So in time, you go back and forth between being here and being here. That's how it works, but I don't expect you to understand it because we're not taking any time to explain it. What?
The time-dependent one, it looks at the actual energy, like multiple energy levels.
Yeah, the wave could be a sum of the one that's high energy and the one that's low energy, but they vary in sign with time, the sum of them, so they reinforce and then they cancel. That's how it works, but that's not what we're supposed to be talking about. It is interesting.
So conceptually, like those two peaks, the A and the B, so when they're far apart, it's like
It's like kind of represented a bond. Like they're like,
when they're far apart, it's like the two different independent atoms.
Two independent atoms, okay.
But when they're close together, it's a double minimum. And the double minimum actually looks like this for atoms.
Okay.
Right? Not like this. It's Coulomb law, right? Okay. But it's the same idea. You can have a wave that's in one, a wave that's in the other, or the sum of the two, or the difference of the two.
Oh, okay, okay.
So that aspect of it is the same as the problem we looked at.
Okay.
Like those two nuclei aren't repelling each other?
Oh yeah, they're also repelling one another.
So why aren't we considering where they're energetically?
But we can calculate the quantum mechanical problem, the biggest quantum mechanical problem is the kinetic energy of the electron.
Yeah.
The nucleus is not moving very much, doesn't have to move very much. So this means you can get what the energy would be if the nuclei were this far away and stationary. But then you can get what the energy would be if they were this far apart and this far apart and this far apart. So now you got the energy, you've taken into account the hard part, the energy of the electron, for all different positions of the nuclei. Now you can draw a curve that says this is what the potential energy would be for different, and add in the nuclear, add in the nuclear. So now you have the whole system as a function of this. And now you can treat it as motion of nuclei and treat that quantum mechanically, knowing the potential which you've calculated this other way.
But theoretically, if we wanted to minimize curvature, wouldn't we just put the two, superimpose the two minima?
That wouldn't minimize the curve. The nuclear charge would now be twice as big.
Yeah, it wouldn't work.
So, and that obviously has to do with nuclear repulsion.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And.
There's a thing called the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. And what that means is you calculate how the electrons behave, assuming the nuclei are stationary. And then once you have that, then you can worry about how the nuclei move.
Okay. And I won't be here on Monday.
Yeah.
Should I get a dean's excuse?
No, you don't have to. I mean, no, I don't take attendance.
Yeah, I know, but I thought specifically Monday because you're giving back the test.
Yeah.
Would be a day I would be noticed.
No.
But okay. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
We're not sorry.
So how did your session go last night?
I think it was really good.
Yeah. Let me turn this off here.
The review session? Maybe we will next time.